I think from a bigger picture perspective, we're in some ways, I feel like, kind of crashing back to normalization, right? I mean, I think coming into the year, we talked about this in terms of a report that we put out every year. And we said, hey, we think that the commercial real estate markets are moving towards normalization. Our expectation in January was this was going to take the entirety of this year and kind of blend into next year to get there. What we're seeing is it's happening now in a matter of months, not a matter of, you know, 12 to 18 months.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. At its core, Wealthion's about delivering insights that make our viewers better informed and then connecting them with actionable solutions for wealth building. So with inflation raging and risk repricing in the stock and bond markets, investors are looking towards tangible assets that may hold their value better, especially ones that produce cash flows that will adjust along with inflation. And one of the more popular asset classes that fits this bill is real estate. Interest in real estate investing has been growing dramatically of late, but the friction in the process makes it a challenge for the regular investor to easily buy in. So today we're going to talk with Ian Formigle, Chief Investment Officer of CrowdStreet, which offers a new way for investors to more easily tap into this market on the commercial side. First, I'll talk with Ian about the dynamics of the commercial real estate market, which covers everything from apartment buildings to office spaces to retail storefronts to factories and hospitals. There are a lot of cross currents right now presenting both challenges and opportunities for investors in this space. We'll then learn about CrowdStreet's model for providing investors with access to private real estate deals. Crowdfunding models like this are new, only made possible by relatively recent regulatory changes, giving access to individual investors that they just didn't have before. And full disclosure, you have to be an accredited investor to participate in CrowdStreet's deals, so they aren't available to everyone. But anyone interested in learning more about real estate investing will benefit from the industry insights that Ian shares with us here. Ian, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, no, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, I'm really excited for this, Ian. So let's just start with a really high level question, which is, what is your current assessment of the real estate market today? I know it seems like a fair amount is beginning to change there with increasing mortgage rates and whatnot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the short answer is the real estate market is doing relatively well overall, very well, you know, in comparison to the stock market, but there's definitely some ripple effects going on, and I'll walk through a few of those. So Adam, as you mentioned right off the top, you know, the number one thing that the real estate markets have been adjusting to this year has been the change in the interest rate environment. So we all saw the spikes in short-term rates. And what's important to know from a real estate perspective is that it's not just the short-term spike in rates where we all have to readjust to when we're thinking about buying real estate or building it. It's the forward curve, right? What do we think rates are going to look like 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, and so forth? Because when we do a real estate deal, we're doing it for multiple years. So, you know, a quarter point move in the short term has one effect, you know, a 150 basis point move 3 or 4 years, 5 years out over that entire period has a much more dramatic effect. And so what we have to do when we're evaluating real estate and we're pricing it is that we have to take those new assumptions and we put those into our models that we value real estate on. And we look at things like the SOFR curve, right? And we have to then think about what do rates look like on a go forward basis. So as that has changed, that changes the cost to, you know, to carry real estate with leverage. And so that's affecting pricing a little bit. So that's number one. Number two is that, you know, you have some real estate that sits on ground leases. It's becoming more and more popular. Essentially what a ground lease is you take the land underneath you and you sell it to a company. iStar is a good example, and Safehold within iStar is a good example of companies that will buy the ground and they'll lease it back to you. And so with rates going up, well, the yield on ground rents are going up too. So you're seeing a lot of ground lease deals all over the country get repriced. Essentially that ground rent is getting higher at its start rate. And so that's affecting the value of the real estate as well. You know, and then the third thing, which is a little bit more, you know, specific to development than it is to acquisitions, are the cost of inputs. As we've all seen, we live in an inflationary environment, and one of those things that's spiking along with all the stuff that we buy and we eat and so forth is the cost of materials that go into producing real estate. So we're talking about lumber, we're talking about steel and concrete and so forth. So those have spiked as well this year. So when you boil it all up, you know, really what we're dealing with is kind of a reanalysis of what does it cost to either build it or buy it and hold it. And when we then bake that into what does that mean from a valuation standpoint? Well, in the acquisition perspective, that's creating a little bit of a downtick in prices. Not a lot. It depends on the asset class. You know, if you're buying a multifamily deal somewhere in the country, it's a slight downtick in price. It's a single digit number. It could be as little as 2%, maybe as large as 8%. But deals are getting retraded dynamically right now. We do hear that every day in the markets. And if you're building it, it does cost a little bit more to build it today than it did, you know, 3 or 4 months ago. And it costs a lot more to build it today than it did a year or two ago. So those are all going to get factored into the equation. Now, from the building perspective, the one thing that's buffered, you know, any kind of hits materially into, you know, projects going or not going is the fact that rents have grown a lot too. So, you know, in a way, the market has kind of bailed out some projects, you know, bit by bit, because, you know, rents are going high. At the end of the day, we're trying to figure out if we can buy something and we can get it to a stabilized yield on cost. What does that cost look like? Well, you know, the yield on cost is the yield is the income and the cost is what it costs to build. So if the denominator goes up, but yet the numerator goes up as well, then you can kind of maintain your overall yield. So a lot of deals are still getting done on the development side. It's really the ability to execute is kind of the number one thing. Like, can you really get the groups to show up on site to build it? Can you really get your materials on site to construct it? Those are some of the biggest things. So when we look at all that stuff, it basically means that the real estate market is more turbulent today than it was last year. I do expect volume to downtick, you know, in the first half of 2022 relative to what we saw in the second half of 2021. But in the grander scheme of things, the market is still progressing. The underlying fundamentals are still in place. And we see that, you know, real estate is basically still, in our opinion, a great place to invest.
Okay, that was a great answer. There's actually a lot of those elements you just ticked off there that I want to dive into a little bit further with you. But first, let's just start with the role of real estate in an investment portfolio. So, you know, if an investor is looking to diversify out of just stocks and bonds or considering real estate, what are the benefits that adding it into your portfolio gives? Why should you want to do this?
Sure. Well, Adam, I think there's a lot of reasons I think that real estate makes sense in a portfolio. I'll touch on kind of what I feel like are some of the three most relevant and some relevant today. The first is just general diversification within a portfolio. The second is real estate's ability to serve as an inflation hedge. And then the third is just the underlying tangibility of the asset. So let's all unpack each one of those. So starting off from a diversification standpoint is that, you know, real estate, when we look at it at a global level, it is the third largest investment asset class after bonds and cash. It's actually has a greater total value in the world than all equity markets combined. So this is kind of a fundamental place to begin. From that perspective, I start to say, well, why not real estate? If we're all investing in stocks, yet the total value of the real estate in the world is bigger than all the stock markets combined, why wouldn't you invest in real estate?
Right. Well, why ignore this massive asset class?
Right. Why ignore a massive asset class? Because I can tell you that institutions don't ignore it and pensions don't ignore it. So hence, why would the individual ignore it? Some of the underlying, you know, fundamentals there are that, hey, it's harder to access. It hasn't been available kind of, you know, or if it is available to investors, it's really more specific to publicly listed real estate investment trusts and so forth. But the, you know, general thesis is, you know, we're at CrowdStreet a believer in modern portfolio theory. You know, real estate is an alternative asset class. Alternative asset classes have been proven by, and there's a lot of studies that show that adding alts to a portfolio is generally a sound practice. It is how, and also look at pensions and endowments, right? It is how pensions and endowments invest. You know, luckily we can study what Harvard and Princeton and Yale invest in every year. And when you look at their annual reports, you're going to see that direct investments in commercial real estate are a component of their portfolio. It ebbs and flows, just like everything else, but they're always there. So that's the first one. The second point is the ability for real estate to serve as a hedge against inflation. And that's something that's obviously relevant to us very much in early 2022. And so what I mean by that is when we look at how real estate is valued, it is essentially valued based upon what is the income that the asset produces and what kind of discount rate do we think that is the appropriate discount rate for real estate. And so, you know, the good news for real estate is its value, its revenue is attributable to the rents that it collects. And rents can be reset at varying frequencies, some every day, like a hotel, some every month, like an apartment building that has rents that has, you know, leases that roll on an annual basis, but leases are coming due every month, you know, kind of tenant by tenant, you know, and some more like less frequently, you know, maybe every year or every 2 years, an office building, a shopping center or so forth. But it's that ability to mark rents to market that gives the real estate the ability to keep up with inflation. And there's great studies that have shown that when we go back to like the last period of like large inflation during the 70s and 80s, that if you look at the indices of the NCREIF and NAREIT, which NCREIF is private real estate, kind of all rolled up commercial level, NAREIT is the public, you know, traded REITs. And you looked at how those performed against the S&P, they soundly beat it. And they delivered a real return over those high inflationary periods, where the S&P over some of those periods actually delivered a real negative return. So I think in today's world, it just kind of makes sense. Hey, if we're seeing rents spiking at double digit rates, you can buy a real estate asset, you know, to the extent that, you know, wages are growing and yet inflation is growing at higher than average normal rates, that your apartment building or your hotel has that ability to kind of keep up with that pace and maintain pace with inflation. So that's second. Third is just this tangibility aspect. And this is something that we see on the marketplace, you know, at CrowdStreet every day that investors really appreciate, in that when we're living in a world right now, and I think 2022 is kind of an interesting example of that. Well, for example, Adam, right now, we're all trying to figure out what is the appropriate way to value high growth tech stocks, because we have a much different opinion today than we did 8 or 9 months ago. Well, then if we think about that, you know, comparison, we look at real estate. Real estate's just more fundamentally tangible, right? This is where we live. It's where we work. It's where we play. It's where we spend time in every day. And so what we see and what we espouse as our own, you know, kind of we eat our own dog food, so to speak, is that, you know, we believe in certain markets around the country, we, you know, more than others, we say, hey, like right now, for example, we think downtown Nashville is an interesting place in the country. People are moving there. The rents are going up. Companies are creating jobs and so forth. So why not over a period of years invest in downtown Nashville? If you do and jobs continue to show up and rents continue to show up, well, then all things considered, asset prices tend to increase over time. So it's just that tangibility factor to say that I know what I'm investing in. I can kind of get it. I can kind of take my own investment thesis about the world and about how the United States is growing or not growing. And I can apply that to a physical asset in terms of real estate. So that tangibility thing is kind of the third thing. So there's more, but I think those are the three of the sum of the main things that we see investors kind of, you know, gravitate towards every day on the marketplace.
All right. That was great, Ian. Very rich, but concise in pounding through those key bullet points there. I might dig into this a little bit more in just a few minutes, but I'm just curious if there's also a tax, if there are tax advantages that you would add to that list.
Yeah, tax advantages would be kind of the next one up, given that these are partnerships that are taxed as a partnership with K-1s. That would be something we could talk about too, because it is powerful for investors. I mean, investors are looking to offset passive gains with passive losses in real estate.
All right, great. Okay, so you just gave a bunch of sort of reasons to consider. I think in general, most people watching, you know, probably have at least a passing, if not even a more active interest in real estate investing. Some may actually already be real estate investors. But I want to dig just into a couple of risk factors that are burning more brightly today than they were even just say a year ago. And obviously the first one is cost of capital. You kind of mentioned how both Financing is getting more expensive, but also inputs are getting more expensive, right? And both of those, you know, kind of can bleed the profit out of a deal, right? So it comes to, hey, can we raise rents high enough? You know, at some point there may be sort of, you know, inability to push rents above a certain level under certain circumstances, right? So do you begin to get sort of a profit squeeze there? So I guess first question is how concerned are you right now about rising interest rates? Because, you know, at least residential mortgage rates, I don't know so much the commercial lending rates, but I know that the 30-year average fixed residential mortgage rate has basically doubled since last summer at this point. That's pretty material. So, and the Fed is still talking about how, hey, they're not slowing down. Right now, I think there's still like 150 basis points or more that the market still thinks is going to be, the Fed is going to hike this year alone. So how big a factor is this? How big of a potential, you know, threat is this to prices? Because mathematically, you know, financing rates go up, housing prices kind of have to come down to a certain extent.
Yeah, sure. You know, I'd say right now in today's environment with the current expectations in place, is that I think from a big picture perspective, what we see is we see interest rates going back towards where they were in 2018, 2019, so to speak. It's still a good time for the market, right? And so, I mean, if you want to quantify that, you know, what we've seen in terms of, well, I'll take the cheapest form of commercial real estate financing. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac kind of have large kind of abundant use, you know, you can get capital. What we would have seen last year at 3 to 3.25% interest rates, you know, 10-year fixed with an interest only period. That's kind of your best typical bread and butter kind of long-term financing on a Class B or Class A apartment complex somewhere in the United States. Today, that looks probably more like 4.5 to 4.75. So while that's jumped up pretty substantially, I mean, it's fair. When we look at 2018 and 2019, they were probably right. That's right where they were. They were even a little bit higher. You know, a lot of deals were still getting done. Commercial real estate was still appreciating in that period. So I think from a bigger picture perspective, we're in some ways, I feel like, kind of crashing back to normalization, right? I mean, I think coming into the year, we talked about this in terms of a report that we put out every year. And we said, hey, we think that the commercial real estate markets are moving towards normalization. Our expectation in January was this was going to take the entirety of this year and kind of blend into next year to get there. What we're seeing is it's happening now in a matter of months, not a matter of, you know, 12 to 18 months. And so, you know, that's creating a little bit of turbulence in the short term. But I do think that ultimately where we end up is a market that looks a lot more normal than it did last year. And by abnormal last year, I mean that we saw essentially rents growing at what I would characterize as unsustainable rates, multifamily rents up solid double digits, industrial rents up solid double digits.
Right, double digits in a single year, right? Yeah.
Up double digits in a single year. And in places like Miami, up 30%. I mean, it's pretty easy to say that rent can't increase 30% every year in Miami, right? That's unsustainable. Absolutely. Pretty soon, you know, we're going to be paying $50,000 a month for an apartment if that continues. So knowing that that can't happen, then we ultimately have to come back to the perspective that rent growth has to normalize. What we saw was essentially, you know, income growth and free money coming out of the pandemic, chasing assets, but then also kind of this fast forward of where people were migrating in the country. And that created a perfect storm of asset appreciation, you know, again, like I said, fueled by really relatively free money. Money's going to have to go back to being a normal cost of capital. And I think that's where it is going right now. You know, if it continues to go, and if we see that Fannie Freddie loan go from 4.75% to 6%, okay, that's real. That is going to have an effect on commercial real estate prices. If it can kind of stay relatively in the range of where it is now, moves up maybe 20 or 50 basis points, but not over 100 basis points, then I ultimately believe that you're going to see the markets look more rational. You're still going to see, we still think that we see rent growth. And if you look at groups like CoStar out there, they're projecting rent growth. Even today, right now, we're still seeing rent growth that I think is higher than normal. Trade outs are still looking like double digits. But double digits is more like 10 to 11%. But overall, we think that you see normalization being that that trend has to go down to like 6% rent growth, 4% on its way back to longer term trends of 2-3% rent growth. And with that, you know, if rates continue to kind of go where we think they're going to go, then the market's going to look a lot like the middle to the lighter part of last cycle within the next year or two.
Okay. All right. I'm going to keep going through some of these factors and just want to underscore that, you know, real estate is a persisting asset, meaning if it turns out conditions aren't perfect to buy it today, they may be great, you know, in a couple of years or two. And so, you know, we're not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater here, but we're trying to just get a sense for, you know, if someone's going to be enter the market, is this a good time to enter? I'm kind of getting eventually to that question too, just to give you a
Sure.
heads up. Is this a good time to enter for a first-time person, or should they wait to see as the dust sort of settles here? But let me ask a few more of these sort of risk factors. The second, and you gave some notice to this too, but it's sort of the impact of COVID. And when I say COVID, I talk about I mean both kind of the work from home phenomenon, which has sort of shaken up the box a little bit, and definitely caused migration patterns that weren't happening beforehand. I'm talking about maybe the impact to commercial real estate, and there I'm talking more sort of office space and whatnot, where we just might not need as much as we used to have going forward. But then I'm also talking about the supply chain disruptions that COVID largely caused, that, you know, are resulting in both higher input costs, but also, you know, challenge to get the labor to actually, you talked earlier about execution, you know, to be able to actually build these things on time and whatnot. So how much is that all complicating the landscape right now?
Yeah, Adam, the effects of COVID on the commercial real estate market have been pretty fascinating. I mean, good and bad in myriad ways. So let's talk through kind of some of both. Let's start with the bad. So on the bad side is to say that, yeah, absolutely, COVID negatively affected the office market. We all understand that. Now, coming out of the pandemic, it's really interesting to see where office sits today. And so what I mean by that is that if we look at what do we think a normal office market looks like going forward, I do agree that with you that I think that it looks like somewhat lower net demand than it looked like pre-pandemic. How much lower? Who knows? But I do think that there is this idea that hybrid work is a real thing. It's part of how our company operates and how it will operate going forward, for example. So we're just one micro data point out there. But I think a lot of companies are thinking that through. But what's interesting to see now is that there is an interest in coming back to the office. We are seeing companies announce this every day. But the question is, how do you come back to the office and what do you want that office to look like once you do come back to it? And my general thesis is that office needs to be more compelling. That office environment, I should say, really needs to be more compelling today than it was in 2019. Right? We now have more flexibility and we have the ability, if we want, to work at home more frequently than we did in the past. So what does working at home get you? It gets you convenience. It's really easy, right? It's down the hall. But what is it also? Well, you're by yourself and the food's not so great. It's whatever you can make in the kitchen, right? And also, and you're lacking that ability to kind of interact daily with colleagues. And even do things like go out afterwards, get a coffee, get a beer, do what, you know, and interact with, you know, with a company. So I do think that when we think about coming back out of the pandemic, I do feel that in that certain employees are going to want to get back into an environment where they're around other people. I think how much also depends on how old you are. I think the more advanced you are in your career and senior you are in your position, you're going to gravitate towards maybe more time out of the office than in the office. And the more that you're younger and really are looking and thirsty for you know, learning, you're going to want to be in the office. But with that said, the office still has to be, I think, more engaging and more vibrant than it was in the past. So that's going to create a demand for higher quality. It's also going to create, also, we already seen this demand for higher safety levels. So what's your air filtration system? Do you have the right elevators? Are they touchless? All these things are now in our minds in a way that they simply weren't in 2018 and 2019. And so what that's doing in the office market is it is to some degree bifurcating it into higher quality, newer office, really well located office, and then kind of everything else. And so if I look at it in an office building today, the one that I'm bullish on, its recovery, is one that sits in a good location in a market that ultimately 3 or 4 years down the road, you have confidence that there will be more people coming to work there than there are today. And that that asset sits in a strategic location in its submarket, so in its neighborhood, kind of in the city center or its suburban location. And that it's proximate to amenities, like good restaurants and cafes and so forth, like what's around you, what's even in your lobby. And also, what's the overall quality of your office space itself? Like, how nice is it? How good is the light? All these things are really important, because if it's compelling, you do want to spend time in it. Versus the stuff that I'm not bullish on, I would call that Class B commoditized, you know, buildings. And we all kind of know what those look like. They look old. They look like they have low ceiling heights.
The track lighting, the cubicles, yeah.
Everything, right? It's the place you walk in, you're like, God, do I really need to be here? Like, I'd rather just go outside, or I'd rather go down the street to a cafe. That type of environment is going to be difficult to attract employees to come back to, because it's just not compelling. And if you can live, stay at home, well, then that's the one that I'm going to want to stay at home and not go to. So I do think that those types of buildings are really going to struggle for years to come. And I honestly think some of them are going to get repurposed. And we're already seeing that. Some certain types of deals that may be in a good location, but just are functionally obsolete, people are looking at turning those into apartments or turning them into hotels. Like, it's happening. So I do think that, that is kind of a bit of a reckoning coming for the office market. But overall, in 2025, I do think the office market looks a lot better than it does today. And we are seeing people return to the office. I think that's going to continue over the course of the next few years.
All right. And forgive me for not knowing the answer to this. I just don't follow the commercial market as closely as you do. Has the office space had a pretty big reckoning since 2020? I mean, I know that it was practically a year where a lot of spaces were just empty, right? So I've got to assume that to a certain extent that did impact prices. I know the residential market's still done quite well after all the stimulus and everything, yeah. But I guess where I'm going with this is, has there already been a downward repricing in the commercial office space? And now perhaps the opportunity is, as you're saying, for the right new build, you know, the building, the new office of the future, there's good opportunity there because, you know, prices are lower right now, and there's going to be opportunity as people start coming back in whatever way they're going to come back to work.
Yeah. And you are correct, Adam, that the office market has been deteriorating in terms of price. There's two things to look at there. There's one called occupancy rate. That's literally what's leased. But really important is to look at what we call utilization rate. And that's how many people are showing up in the office every day. Because if we have a building that might be relatively well leased, but it has a super low utilization rate, well, then you kind of know that when those leases come to renewal, that renewal probability is pretty low, right? If nobody's using the office, does the company really want to renew it? Probably not. So when we look around the country, some of the markets that had the lowest utilization rates during the pandemic look like New York and San Francisco. They fell to like almost single digit levels during the depths of the pandemic. And they've struggled to come back to levels that look like, you know, right now they're kind of in the 30% range. While there are some other markets, Sunbelt locations, for example, Austin, Texas, or, you know, other parts of the country like that. And, you know, Austin's actually been kind of a bellwether in terms of utilization rates, because it's kind of hung in there in the 30s to 40s, and it's actually now back up in the high 50s. So I do think that there is some disparity in terms of where people are returning to the office. That's going to change, and that some are going to be a little slower, some are going to be a little faster. From a pricing perspective, you are seeing some this stress now hit the market. We've just seen some recent announcements. New York had, you know, a couple big deals where they handed the keys back to the lender. And we see that in Chicago, where there's, you know, loan defaults and so forth. So I do think that right now is a really interesting time from an asset price perspective in office, because the distress has hit it. That's going to cause deals to downtick in price 20 to 30%. It's the closest thing that looks like the stock market right now in the real estate world. But at the same time, that creates, I think, the opportunity to buy it right, provided that you get kind of the underlying thesis correct, and that, hey, I think this building can return to normalization one day, but I'm going to have to invest in it. I'm going to have to, you know, improve it. But it sits in a good location, but it is also kind of timed out from, you know, that current owner would bought what they thought was a stabilized deal, and it became a highly unstabilized deal, and it fell below the debt coverage ratio. And there's only so long that you can carry a building before you run out of money and have to give it
Right.
back. Then it resets. Then the new owner comes in. They can actually charge lower rents. We've seen this cycle in, cycle out. There's nothing like a price reset to reinvigorate an office market. And that is happening like today. Not as much last year. There was a little bit more of the kicking the can, but today it's kind of like people are throwing in the towel. They're like, that's it. I'm out. The market didn't come back fast enough, and it's creating, I think, some great buying opportunities.
Okay, great. So just to put some words in your mouth and feel free to correct them, but real estate, like any other market, but I guess particularly for real estate, it's a cyclical market, and the savvy investor ideally wants to, buy in, at the market bottom where, you have these opportunities that create real long-term value if you make a smart decision at that time. I see you sort of nodding as I'm saying this.
Agreed. If I mean, in essence, if you're willing to take risk and you want to scoop what you think is a market bottom, that's office right now. It is on sale, and you do have to believe in a better future for office in order to buy, get to basically feel comfortable buying it. But if you think the office market is going to look better 4 years from now than it does today, there's deals to be had. They're all over the country, and you know, getting to them can be a little bit, you know, one by one. But it's a great spot to take high risk capital for sure.
Okay, thanks. And I want to get into kind of the nuts and bolts of how to do the investing here. But real quick, I got one more risk factor to put up here. And you don't have to agree with this, but if I can ask you just to sort of assume this is going to happen and then tell me what you think the impact is going to be. And that's the risk of recession. All right, we're seeing, I would say, a lot of storm clouds on the horizon that are leading a lot of macro thinkers, the folks that many of the folks I interview on this channel on a regular basis, to say, hey, look, the risk of recession is increasing here. Cost of capital, that just suppresses overall economic growth as the cost of capital rises. The Fed is very intently and very publicly saying we're trying to kill demand here right now, right? So they're doing things to cool off the job market, to cool down the housing market, to create, and to a certain extent, a bit of a negative wealth effect, so that people spend less, and therefore the inflation, begins to come down a little, the price inflation begins to come down. So assume for a moment that we do enter recession in the next year or so. What kind of impact could that have right now on commercial real estate and as an investment standpoint? Would that sort of set back the better entry points until the recession is over? I mean, maybe that's just obvious, but anyways, and I'm sure you track this data, so I'd love to hear your general thoughts.
So first, you know, the caveat being that I'm not a macroeconomist, you know, my personal take is I right now we don't think, I mean, if I had to bet yes or no on a recession later this year or early next year, we're still thinking no. But I would also say that, you know, the economy is 70% the consumer. And so I think the wild card here is what is the psyche of the consumer later this year. In some degree, I feel like there's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy here, right? If the consumer believes that we're going into a recession, then their behavior actually might drive us into one. If the consumer starts to get a little bit more optimistic and think that, hey, maybe what happened isn't, you know, maybe the worst is behind us from a market perspective, then I think we're okay. But with that said, let's turn it to the commercial real estate market. So what I would say, so to me, the biggest question now remaining is recession or not recession, is if we say yes, recession, what type of recession? Shorter and milder or longer and protracted? Because that's going to have a material effect on the commercial real estate market. And so one thing that's important to keep in mind is that the commercial real estate market does not behave like the stock market in the sense that we don't have the ability to enter and exit every day at our will, right? These are single assets that are coming up for sale, or we're building them at a period of time, and they are single points of entry and exit. And if you don't do that deal today, the next time you might get a look at it is in 5 years from now, maybe a decade from now. So then what you have to do in that case is you have to kind of take that calculated bet. Okay, this particular deal is coming to me right now. I like it. It's in a good location. I like the long-term fundamentals of it, but do I want to pay the asking price today? And if you think, well, I think there's a mild recession here, you can bake that into your equation, and that would translate into maybe a slight deviation in price, but not a huge one, not a 15 or 20% change, but maybe a single digit percent change. And you basically proceed and you do that deal, because when we buy real estate, we are operating it for multiple years. So if we acquire it in 2022, really what we're asking ourselves is, what does it look like to sell it sometime later this decade? And a short-term milder recession is really just kind of a speed bump along the way. It's not going to materially change the outcome of that deal in 2027 or 2028. Now, moving to the next scenario, okay, longer, more protracted recession, something that looks like the GFC. Okay, now I have to really think twice, because what I'm now saying is, if I buy that asset today, I'm signing up for 3 to 4 years of real pain before it starts to turn around. When it does turn around, it's going to be slower. It's going to be more protracted. And while 5 years down the road, the asset might look okay, I'm probably not getting to where I thought I was going to get in the mild recession scenario. So that to me is like, that's the million-dollar question. So again, my personal bias is, overall, I don't think we're going to go recession. So I'm viewing the opportunity to retrade deals at, call it 5 to 15% of, kind of 2021 pricing as, a reasonably attractive entry point. And essentially things kind of went on sale a little bit. Do think that ultimately we get back on track, normalization kind of hits the market, and 2024 looks like, more like 2016. And, and if that's the case, then the entry points today look really attractive. But if you think a more longer protracted GFC type environment is on the horizon, then it's hard to say that buying at today's prices is the right price. You'd rather wait a year or two, buy it at a steeper discount, and then be ready to kind of ride out the storm.
All right, great. And I appreciate you prognosticating as I'm sort of forcing you to look through a crystal ball there. But, I think the key takeaway from that is every investor, should do their own calculus at the end of the day about all these probabilities we talked about. And, if you think you're not comfortable with the current recession risks, well, as you said, you don't have to buy today. You can wait if you think there will be a better entry point tomorrow. And I think you also made a really good point too, which is that real estate is something that you buy and hold for good chunks of periods. Right. And so you can ride out recessions, especially if they're more mild, like you were saying. But I mean, when you go to sell the property at the end of your tenure holding it, it's going to be priced on its forward earning potential anyways. So right. To your point, you might not have gotten the returns you had hoped for, along the way, if there's a recession that's longer than you expected. But if you end up holding it back to a recovery, you can still get a really nice sale price, if you're selling it under good conditions. And I see you nodding here. All right, so let's get to the fun part. Let's actually talk about, hey, I'm interested in actually potentially investing in this space. Let's talk about the CrowdStreet model, because you remove a lot of the friction here for people. And you also, I believe, give investors access to better deals than they're probably likely to find on their own as an individual just sort of sniffing around out there. This is a very sort of deal specific market, which means you sort of have to have visibility into what deals are out there. You're competing with people who can raise a lot more capital. A lot of the really good deals operate at a scale that an individual has a hard time financing or even qualifying to get a little slice of it. So if you can just sort of talk about, the model that you guys pursue at CrowdStreet and what it would look like for somebody to invest using that model.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I'd be happy to. So what CrowdStreet set out to build and is now, achieved and still growing, still have a long way to go, but we're kind of reaching a point of market relevancy, is that we're taking a real estate syndication model and we're massively scaling it. And so what I mean by that is that we were born out of legislation in 2012, part of the Jobs Act, and Title II of the Jobs Act, which went live in the fall of 2013, enabled for the first time since 1933, the public dissemination, or in essence, the advertising of a private Reg D deal. And so these on the marketplace, or what we're doing, are essentially private Reg D commercial real estate deals. And so what's important to know about that is that real estate syndication has been going on for like literally hundreds of years. I mean, you can go back to like Amsterdam and see deals getting syndicated in the 1600s. But in today's format, and I'd say in recent past, what real estate syndication in the United States has looked like is it has looked like what we call the country club model. And that is somebody in one location around the country gets their hands on a piece of property to build or a property to buy. And they kind of, what we would say, pass the hat, go to their friends and family and say, hey, I'm going to raise some millions of dollars. I'm going to put together a simple, private placement memorandum. And you want in this deal. And we're going to go buy this property. We're going to go fix it up. We're going to go sell it one day. And we think we're going to make money. And historically speaking, that has been a very local phenomenon. It had, people have done it. I've done it in my past as well. But it usually entails like who you know and who your friends know. And do you get an introduction? And then do you get access to that one particular deal? And it usually was local. It might have been in your city, definitely probably in your state. But it wasn't really institutionalized at a national level. And so, and also it was really difficult to understand it. You're being shown some numbers. We're going to buy something at this price. We're going to sell it at this price. And does that make sense? I don't know. Like you're just being shown like a piece of paper and say, do you want to sign up for what is being asked of me of like $250,000 too?
So back of a cocktail napkin by your golfing buddy. Yeah,
totally. Right. So that was how deals got done. And then what happened is that in 2013, they said, hey, we can do it a different way. You can advertise it. So essentially you can put the deal first and the relationship second, but it has to be all accredited investors, and we have to have a mechanism to verify them. So CrowdStreet saw that as an opportunity. We said that if you can do these deals publicly, you can put them online. And if you could put them online, we could give people access to them all over the country. Now we'd have this phenomenon where people could live in Florida and invest in a deal in Seattle and vice versa. And that was just really, that was almost impossible before. So, but it was all predicated on two things. One, you had to put it on a website. Two, you had to build a robust, kind of e-commerce engine for real estate investing underneath it, right? It has to look kind of like eventually the Amazon for real estate. So we set out to do that. It took years to kind of get it really going and get it to a point where it really started to work at scale. But it's now working relatively well at scale. We did fund $1.2 billion in equity last year, and we continue to grow. And what's important to also really understand about this whole phenomenon is that real estate private equity, it is capital intensive. And what I mean by that is to acquire one property of what we call the middle market being a property that's going to trade from anywhere from $50 to $100 million, give or take. Now, like we're going to have debt in that property and we're going to have equity. And that equity can look like $20 million, $30 million, $40 million. In the old world of the country club deals, that was simply too much money to raise with your friends and family. Think about it. You and your network, can you put together $40 million to go take down a deal? Probably not. What you needed now is you need scale. So we view that as an opportunity to say, look, really good deals around the country, ones that trade efficiently, that have really good companies that are backing them, that get to better reliability of execution of returns. That looks like companies that are doing it every day. That looks like assets that look like 80 to 100 million bucks. And so, but to get there, you have to syndicate $20 or $30 million. So we had to get to that point to be able to hit that kind of number. And it took us until about last year, but we got there and we can now syndicate, on a case-by-case basis, not every deal, but there are deals that will hit anywhere from, 20 million and up, while a lot of deals we will raise 10 million on. And what's important is that is now relevant to the industry at the highest level. And so that is essentially now from the investor perspective, that is giving the investor the seat at the table that they never had. Because in the past, that developer or operator had to say, look, I need $40 million to do my deal. How am I going to get it? I can go get a term sheet from a Goldman Sachs, a Morgan Stanley, insert name of, institution, and I can go get that money. It's got strings attached to it. It does. It comes with a lot of looking over my shoulder and a lot of things that I'm not excited about, but I can go get that money. Alternatively, today, our new kind of proposition to those greatest, and what we think are best in class operators and developers is the prospect of saying, look, there's a new way of getting capital. It looks like thousands of investors all over the country who are investing at an increment that looks like $50,000 on average, but we are bolting together hundreds to now thousands of investments to get to $20, $30, $40 million in one deal. That never happened before. It happened because of the technology that we built in a marketplace, and it happened because of the legislation that made it possible in 2013. That is what's totally new, and that is what's disrupting the commercial real estate market today, and we think will continue to do so going forward.
All right. Well, really fascinating. And the investor here is, beforehand when it was the Country Club deal, I don't know what exactly type of properties you were getting, but clearly they were not of the scale that you're saying that CrowdStreet's able to offer. And of course, what you're doing is you're tapping in with the new technology, the ability to crowdfund, right? I guess that's why you called it CrowdStreet, right?
Right.
But what that does that I think is exciting is, at that scale you're talking about, where you're raising the 20 to 30 million for a $100 million property or whatnot, is, when you're doing the Country Club deal, you guys aren't funding a hospital or a factory or, a hotel or a massive apartment building, because you just can't raise that kind of capital amongst your buddies, right? Here, you're able to get access to those really big sort of world-class style investment opportunities. And to your point, you're able to attract kind of the best developers to come in and do this, right? Where essentially it's giving you access to a level of quality and a scale that you couldn't have gotten done beforehand. And I also liked how you kind of, made clear too that up until the Jobs Act made this possible, you were pretty much limited to the deals you could find, and most of those deals would be the deals around you, right? Where now you can find, if you think the best deal is one that's happening on the other side of the country, well, great. That's where you can put your money, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I can give you one live example of that. There is a property in investment on the marketplace right now. By the time this interview is public, it'll probably be off the marketplace. But it is the one of the largest office buildings in the Buckhead submarket of Atlanta, right? It is a over 1 million square foot office building, and it literally straddles a freeway. So if you drive on the freeway in Atlanta and you're in Buckhead, and you literally have to drive under this building. You'll hit a tunnel and you'll go out the other side. And so, that's what we would consider. That is a super well-located major institutional asset. The group that we're partnering with is acquiring it from a global bank, and they're going to invest a large amount of money into that project. Right now, contemplating is $70+ million of investment into what will look like a multi-hundred million dollar asset once they restabilize it. And it has, just like everything else, it suffered a little bit during the pandemic, but it has a major tenant. It has a major credit tenant in it in the form of Truist. But it's a that is the type of property that is possible today that just simply wasn't possible, for the individual investor, I don't think, at least, back in the, a decade ago, for example.
All right, great. Look, I got a number of questions we're going to have to bang through here quickly just because we're running out of time. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interest to have you back on again, Ian. So don't worry, you'll get another bite of this apple. I guess first question on this is just, you mentioned publicly traded REITs earlier. So why not just buy a REIT if you want access to real estate exposure in your portfolio? What is it about the direct investment through these crowdfunded syndicates that offers an advantage to those REITs?
Sure. And for starters, there's no knock on REITs. REITs could be a great investment, and they've proven to be a good investment over time. But there is a difference. What we are doing on the marketplace is real estate private equity. And so what I mean by that and what the differences are, one, you're investing more directly into the ownership of the property. When you buy and you invest in a publicly traded REIT, you're really buying the company, right? You're investing in that the org structure, the management, everything that goes into a company, right? So it is a company that is in the business of owning, operating, and selling real estate. But you're buying kind of the whole thing, so to speak, and you're buying their entire portfolio. So if you like Vornado, for example, great, you can go invest in Vornado, high quality REIT. In real estate private equity, you're investing in a specific property, right? You're not even investing in the organization structure of the company that is what we call sponsoring the deal. So XYZ Capital Partners might be buying, ABC Main Street property, major apartment complex in the center of a major city. What you're basically investing is, like, I want to own that asset. I'm going to pay that company fees and potentially a piece of the profits on it in order to operate it, but I'm buying the asset. And that company can even come and go, but I'm in the deal. I'm in the asset. That's the difference in private equity, is you're buying the equity, not necessarily the whole stock. So that's just, it's just a different type of investment. The other thing is from a tax perspective, it's very different. REITs are taxed like stocks, right? You get dividends, you pay dividend tax on a REIT. REITs are structured such that they pass through all of the revenues. You don't get to actually pass through the losses, but you get the revenues, that the income that gets passed through. In commercial real estate private equity, it is taxed like a partnership, which means that you have the benefit of the income, but you also get the benefit of the passive losses. And so what that can look like on an annual basis is, I own a property, it gets depreciated. That depreciated creates an annual tax loss on my return. That's a passive loss, so I have to have passive gains to offset it. But meanwhile, I'm maybe even receiving yield off the property. I'm getting quarterly dividend, quarterly, I would say, distributions that are sent to me. But when I get my K-1, that's the important thing. You get a K-1, not a 1099. So, and that costs a little bit more to bake into your tax return. But it would show you that you're getting a loss at the end of the year while actually received distributions throughout the year. And what that really translated is income turns into long-term capital gains at exit while you are offsetting short-term passive gains through your passive losses.
Okay, great. Well, you just removed another one of my questions, which was the tax benefits here. So you did a great job of describing them there. So, I mean, obviously to folks watching, if that's of interest to you, before investing, sit down with your accountant and really kind of walk through what impact that could have given your own personal situation. But I know from firsthand, and you probably know a lot better than I do, Ian, you know, there's a lot of people that use that strategy to great advantage.
Absolutely. It's, you know, and particularly when you amass a portfolio, the annual passive losses, you know, they're real, and they're real earlier in the holding period than later. One thing that's important to understand is that different types of properties have greater amounts of depreciation than others. Some of the ones that have the ability to accelerate depreciation, those look like multifamily properties, because you have things in them such as refrigerators, you know, other forms of appliances, carpeting, lighting, you know, carpeting and appliances, they can be accelerated. And we do something what's called cost segregation. I'm getting a little bit into the accounting part of this, but in essence, you have straight line depreciation. And that's like, we take the overall physical asset, we value it, and then we depreciate it incrementally over a period of 27 and a half years for an apartment complex, or longer for, you know, something that looks like an office building. But then you have that ability to accelerate the depreciation on the things that are inside of it. And that's where you can have meaningful short-term losses that can then offset your short-term gains and be really powerful from a tax perspective. But again, it all depends on your personal situation.
Okay, great. All right. Well, look, once an investor gets interested in this and says, okay, I'm curious, you know, what do these guys got? What do they do? I assume they go to crowdstreet.com, and there's sort of some way to see what the available inventory is out there.
Yeah. So I'd say that the path for a typical investor looks like the following. First thing is, to your point, go to crowdstreet.com, log in, you know, it's prompting you to create an account, takes a few minutes. It'll ask you a few questions, verify your email address, and then you're in. And then what being in means is that you get access to start seeing all the deals on the marketplace. You know, with or without logins, there's a wealth of information that's available on the website to educate investors in terms of what is real estate private equity, what are different asset classes, what are some of the tax ramifications that we discussed, and so on. And what I always recommend to every investor is start reading, and also start attending webinars. We are a marketplace, which means that deals go live for investment on a weekly basis, typically right now about 2 to 3 per week. And they always are kicked off with a live webinar. That is where the operator or developer hosts a one-to-many format where they talk about themselves, what they're buying or what they're building, why they think they can make money over the, you know, intended holding period, and what that really means for investors. And before anybody invests, I always recommend attend a webinar, show up, start understanding how these deals are pitched to investors from operators and developers, and what are some of the things that go into them, because you're going to start to hear things like rent growth and cap rates and stabilized occupancy, all these types of, you know, data and nomenclature that go into commercial real estate. It'll help you get up the curve, and then, you know, then go back and do some more research, and then reach out to somebody at CrowdStreet. There's people who can talk about deals. We've got an investor relations team. They're great, and they can help you understand more about what's going on. And then it's also really important to understand that there's different ways to invest on the marketplace. There is the one-off investing in a deal. Those are kind of what we call the active and power users. They want to come in, they make their own decisions. They look like the people that pick their own stocks, and they want to invest, you know, $50,000 at a time and assemble a portfolio. About 70% of active investors on CrowdStreet are repeat, and the average repeat investor has invested over 6 times. So there's kind of this serial investing that's going on. With that said, CrowdStreet does offer a series of different funds. Those are more oriented towards investors who like the idea of getting the exposure to commercial real estate private equity, but don't want to go through the picking and choosing process, but would rather turn that over to an investment committee. I'm a member of that committee. I'm actually the chairman of that committee, but it's a 5-member committee. And, you know, we have real estate experts that are assembled to kind of help pick and choose amongst all the deals. There's even privately managed accounts. So for those individuals who want to amass a portfolio of individual deals, but want help doing it, there's options there as well. Really, the bottom line is there's a lot of different ways to get involved. It all begins with creating an account and getting educated. And also keep in mind, it's a marketplace. There's always a deal around the corner. Sometimes investors get kind of, you know, really want to jump in fast. It's great if you're ready to jump in, but the point is jump in at the point that's right for you after you feel comfortable, you know, proceeding to invest.
Okay. And for investors, I'm going to ask sort of, is there a minimum deal size, but the investors, do they need to be accredited investors to participate in this?
Yeah, the answer is yes. So investing on CrowdStreet is for accredited investors. You know, the definition of that is on an income basis, either $200,000 per year individually or $300,000 jointly, with the expectation to do that going forward. If you're going to qualify by net worth equals $1 million exclusive of your personal residence. That is the benchmark that ultimately investors need to adhere to in order to become eligible to invest. The minimum investment size on the CrowdStreet marketplace is $25,000. Like I mentioned a few minutes ago, the average investment size is about 50. That's just simply where investors have chosen to invest, but the minimum is 25.
Okay, great. And I'd love to dig deeper. We don't have time to do it, but you know, about the committee that you chair that builds basically funds of the deals that are out there, so that if somebody is new and doesn't want to necessarily roll the dice and picking an individual deal yet because they maybe don't feel like they've got the expertise yet to do that, to be able to kind of buy into it, you know, a fund that experienced people are saying, we think this is a good collection of properties. That's a really interesting alternative for them. All right. And, you know, and for folks watching, if you're not an accredited investor, hopefully the education process that we went through in the first, you know, 85% of this interview is good in terms of helping ground you in what's happening in the investing real estate market. And there are other ways to invest besides CrowdStreet. So hopefully the education has been useful for you, you know, by itself here. All right, real quick, CrowdStreet's been around for how long? And I'm asking that question mostly to see if you've been around enough to have any exits from deals yet. So is there a track record yet of, you know, being able to say, yeah, we did this deal, we funded it, and it ended up over the life of the deal delivering X percent return?
The answer is yes. So CrowdStreet dates back to 2012. That's when the co-founder, Darren Powderly, kind of first started putting together the sketches of what would become CrowdStreet and the CrowdStreet marketplace. The company officially incorporated it around March of 2013. By the end of that year, Darren had found his other co-founder, Torstein, who is our CEO for today. And then the marketplace went live in April of 2014. So we are now over 8 years into our journey as a public marketplace. Over the course of that time, we have done just under 650 individual offerings. And that's exclusive of the funds and other things that we offer at CrowdStreet. That has been conducted by over 300 different sponsors. Those are the operators and developers out there. That has translated, if you sum up all the real estate that's been on the CrowdStreet marketplace, the value of that real estate, that looks like a little over $25 billion today and counting. We have had, to your answer your point at question, Adam, on exits, yes. We have had, as of the end of May, 126 deals go full cycle. If wow. You blend, yeah, so we've had exits. The amount of total distributions coming through both the cash flow component of the deals, plus the realization of those exits now looks like about $670 million and counting. The total amount raised and funded into the marketplace is now about $3.3 billion and counting. But if we look at those 126 deals and say, what did that look like on an annualized rate of return, which in real estate, we use the IRR calculation, right? Internal rate of return. That basically is a time-weighted way to look at annualized returns, and it takes, you know, cash flows and realizations into consideration. Because in real estate, you might get some amount of return along the way, but you're going to get probably the majority of your return at exit.
On
So
the
we kind of
exit.
look at that total journey in terms of the returns and say at the end of the day, you know, time counts, so it really matters. And that IRR over the 126 deals is currently a 17.7 annualized rate of return.
Wow.
That looks like on an equity multiple basis, right? A dollar in gets you how much out? It's a 1.49. So a dollar in has typically gotten you $1.49 out. And that has occurred over an average holding period of 2.9 years. It's also important to note, right? We do private equity deals. So when you invest, you don't just decide to, like, you know, take your money out 3 months down the road or 3 years, you know, down the road. You are signing up for the duration of that particular deal. But on average, that particular deal has taken just under 3 years to complete to get you that 17.7% annualized rate of return on the 126 and counting. So that will change as we go forward. Hopefully it goes up. It might go down. I don't know. But it is always live on our marketplace. So you can scroll down from the homepage. You can click on realize track record, and we make it transparent. At CrowdStreet, we're all about transparency. And I would say that, you know, good or bad, we're going to show you the deals that made money, the deals that lost money. If you look into that 17.7% annualized rate of return, you've got some deals on the upside that have looked like over 100% annualized rate of return, and you've got a few deals in there that lost all of their money. So, you know, when we look at it from private equity perspective, which is why we do overall think that a portfolio perspective is the right way to look at it, is that if you invest in 10 deals, you should probably expect that of those 10, a couple, two to three, are going to perform extremely well. The middle band of those are going to probably perform somewhere where you think they would. There's going to be a few that are going to perform less than you thought, but would probably either still give you a return, or if they do lose a money, a little bit of money. And there's one to two that have the potential for material loss, being 50% to 100% of your money. But when you blend that all together, that's how you get back to the higher rates of return. And that way you would see that is indicative in our track record. Some were off the charts, a couple lost all their money, but when you put it all together is where you get to that 17.7% IRR.
Got it, got it. And that IRR isn't taking into account the individual's potential benefit from any tax loss pass-throughs or stuff like that, right?
That is
So your
correct.
personal return could be even higher if you're getting tax benefits in your favor.
That is just simply the returns that are coming from the cash flow of the deals on the marketplace. Everybody's individual tax situation is different, so we can't really begin to contemplate what that looks like on an after-tax basis, because that can run a spectrum.
Right. All right. Last question before I invite you to tell people where to go to learn more about CrowdStreet. Can people, and I'll take a quick answer here, but can people invest in these CrowdStreet deals through retirement accounts if they want to? Obviously, that complicates sometimes the tax issues, but if that's where they've got the majority of their wealth, can they put funds in an IRA, you know, to use here?
The answer is, yeah, over 80% of the time, yes. Every now and then, no, but typically, yes.
Okay, great. All right. Well, for people who've really enjoyed this and want to learn more about the CrowdStreet model there, start maybe looking at, you know, what potentially might be available, where should they go? Is it as simple as crowdstreet.com?
Yeah, go to crowdstreet.com. Like I said, you can, you know, sign up, create an account, start wandering around, you know, reach out. There's places to reach out for more information on the website itself. That's the easiest way and fastest way for investors to start getting up to speed. You know, what I always kind of talk about on webinars too, you know, and interviews is that, you know, I always like talking deals. People can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm the only Ian Formigli on the LinkedIn platform, so I'm pretty easy to find. You can connect with me there, and we can chat about deals for anyone who wants to just kind of find me personally. But other than that, you know, there's a lot of information on the website, and there's a large team at CrowdStreet. At this point, I think we're over 230 employees. So, you know, there's people at CrowdStreet. There's a real team there. who can help guide you to start determining if this is a good fit for you.
All right. All right. Well, that's a generous offer. I'm guessing you're probably going to get contacted by a few folks there, Ian, once they find you there on the Grad Street platform. Ian, really appreciate you coming on, sharing so much of your time here. We actually went a lot longer than I thought I would, but because we had a lot of great material to dig into. Thanks for educating people both about the macro situation of the markets, but sort of the nuts and bolts of how to invest. And then obviously, if Grad Street is right for folks, well, you might actually hear from some folks that are interested in some deals there. So thanks for giving so much of your time. Really looking forward to having you back on the program. Folks, if you like these deep dive interviews like this into a particular alternative investment sector, please just let me know in the comments section below. We'll continue to do more of these going forward. Again, Ian, thanks so much for your time. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks, Adam. It was my pleasure.